This is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins, John Russell, and Dan Novak. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Jill Robbins.
A Saudi Arabian women's rights activist has brought attention to computer programs known as spyware. These programs record activity on electronic devices and give those records to users of the software. Activist Lujan Al-Haflul got help from computer experts who studied her iPhone. They reported finding evidence that the software of an Israeli security company, the NSO Group, was on Al-Haflul's phone. Now, the U.S. government is investigating how the NSO Group's software was able to get on the phones of government officials and activists around the world. The activist discovered a mysterious kind of image file on her phone last year. Researchers believe it was left behind by the spyware. The discovery led to a lot of evidence suggesting the Israeli spyware maker was involved in hacking her phone. The evidence started a series of legal and government actions against NSO. Reuters news agency was the first to report on how the hack was discovered. Al-Haflul is one of Saudi Arabia's most famous activists. She is known for helping lead a campaign to end the ban on women drivers in the country. She was found guilty of harming national security and jailed in 2020. She was released from jail in February 2021. Soon after her release, the activist received an email from Google warning her that state-supported hackers had tried to get into her Gmail account. She became fearful that her iPhone had been hacked as well. Al-Haflul then contacted the Canadian research group Citizen Lab. She asked them to search her device for evidence. After 6 months of looking through her iPhone records, Citizen Lab researcher Bill Marzak made a discovery. The software aimed at spying on her phone, which was stealing her messages, had left a copy. It did not remove itself. Marzak said the computer code left by the attack provided direct evidence that NSO built the spying tool. "It was a game changer," said Marzak. "We caught something that the company thought was uncatchable." Citizen Lab and Al-Haflul's discovery was used in the legal case that Apple Inc., the maker of the phone, brought against NSO in November 2021. Apple says it is seeking to ban NSO Group from using any Apple software, services, or devices. The incident also created anger in Washington as U.S. officials learned that NSO's software was used to spy on American diplomats. Over the past year, many reporters and activists have tied the spyware industry to human rights violations. These include the International Journalism Collaboration, Pegasus Project. Al-Haflul's case brought more attention to NSO and similar companies. Security researchers said Al-Haflul's discovery was the first to show how the software works without any action by the phone user. In a statement, an NSO spokesperson said, "The company does not operate the hacking tools it sells." Government, law enforcement, and intelligence agencies do. Without going into detail, the company said it had developed ways to investigate misuses of its products. It said it had cut off some users over human rights issues. Last September, Citizen Lab explained to Apple how the attack took place. That permitted Apple to fix the weakness in its system and led the company to warn thousands of other iPhone users who were targeted by NSO software. Apple said the users had been victims of state-sponsored attackers. Apple's legal action against NSO claims the company broke U.S. laws by building products designed to target, attack, and harm Apple users, Apple products, and Apple. People who were not identified but knew about the matter spoke to Reuters. They said at least 9 U.S. State Department employees in Uganda were among those targeted with NSO software. This caused even more criticism of the company in Washington. In November, the U.S. Commerce Department placed NSO on a trade blacklist. The department restricted American companies from selling the Israeli company's software products. In December, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden and 17 other lawmakers called for the Treasury Department to place restrictions on NSO Group and 3 other companies. The lawmakers say the spyware helped governments carry out human rights abuses. I'm Jill Robbins.
Les Ansley has developed an unusual kind of gin, a clear alcoholic drink that is flavored with fruits and seeds. Some of this gin's ingredients have passed through the digestive system of elephants. Les Ansley gets some of the raw materials by going into the South African wilderness, finding elephant waste, smelling it, and then storing it in a bag to use when making the high-end alcohol. The elephants do the work, finding the herbs and fruit that give the gin its taste, explained Ansley. Launched in 2018, Indlovu Gin, named after a local word for elephant, is sold in the United States, Canada, Germany, Switzerland, Japan, and Taiwan. Ansley and his wife Paula export about 1,500 bottles a month. Since the start of this year, 2 of South Africa's biggest sellers, Woolworths and Pick n Play, carry it. The elephants, because they digest so little, they have a very quick gut in transit time, low gut bacteria, and very poor absorption, he told the Reuters news agency. Ansley added, "They get to choose the best leaves and the best fruits and the best flowers and the best plants." As well as the usual gin ingredients, such as juniper and citrus, the dried and washed plant matter from the elephants change with the season and the climate. This gives different tastes to different batches. The date and location of the waste collection are given on the bottles produced, the distiller said. The couple give 15% of the profits to an elephant orphanage, a place that cares for young elephants that have lost their parents. This is another reason that buyers might be interested in the product, besides its unusual nature. But how does gin that is made from elephant waste taste? Bartender Johanna Jones described it as earthy. That's what makes it different, Jones added. I'm John Russell.
Conservative local school boards in the United States have already moved to control how history and race is taught in public schools. Now, some school districts are also finding their larger efforts on diversity, equity, and inclusion challenged by local officials. A school board is a group of elected officials who supervise a school district's budget and educational decisions. Alexis Knox Miller is the equity director at Colorado Springs School District 11, a large and diverse system of 26,000 students. The district was the first in the area to create a formal equity policy. The policy was approved with no opposing votes in May 2020, just 2 days after the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota. That event led to nationwide reflections on the state of race and social justice issues in society, as well as in schools. Knox Miller helped launch a study by the American Institutes for Research. It found that schools with high numbers of special education students, English language learners, students living in poverty, and students of color were scoring lower than other schools. Knox Miller thought the results demonstrated a big need for policies aimed at ensuring that all students had the same opportunities. But critics questioned the study's findings and how they were presented. Conservative candidates ran for the school board and won 3 seats, giving them a majority. The winning candidates had voiced concerns about equity policies. So Knox Miller decided to end her work after more than a year of meetings. American educators say they are feeling the effects of deep divides surrounding the issues of diversity and equity in schools. After George Floyd's killing in 2020, many districts increased efforts to make schools more inclusive places for students and employees of all backgrounds. But intense debate over how schools deal with race is leading some districts to rethink or withdraw plans. People were conflating the definition of equity with critical race theory, Knox Miller said. Critical race theory is based on the idea that systemic racism has deeply shaped American society, laws, and policies. It is often taught in higher education settings. But school officials say critical race theory is not taught in K-12 public school systems. However, that has done little to change the minds of opponents. They say school systems are misspending money, creating racial divisions, and shaming white children by supporting programs they view as critical race theory in disguise. Such criticism has led some districts to stop proposals aimed at making schools more welcoming places for students from diverse backgrounds. Work elsewhere has been affected by heated debates about subjects that have been misrepresented as critical race theory. In a political climate that has already led to arguments over pandemic restrictions and vaccine requirements, equity programs are struggling at some schools, said Dan Domenech. He is the director of the American Association of School Administrators. Districts are thinking twice about what they say and what they do and how they go about doing it, because it is having a chilling effect on the whole equity, diversity, and inclusion movement, Domenech said. Virginia-based group Parents Defending Education has been critical of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. The organization seeks to identify examples of what it sees as problematic programs. On its website, the group identifies one of its goals as fighting indoctrination in the classroom. The organization also seeks a restoration of a healthy, non-political education. In Southlake, Texas, near Dallas, the newly elected conservative majority on the Carroll Independent School District's board killed a diversity action plan in December. The board also ended a diversity planning group as part of a legal settlement. Still, many other programs are continuing as planned. An equity program that schools in Clayton County, Georgia, worked on more than a year ago, was designed to keep politics and emotions out of it, said Superintendent Morsese Beasley. Leaders of the equity group say they plan to use data to drive any policy changes. "That's what equity is about," Beasley told the AP. "Where are the needs? Who needs the resources? What do they need?" I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember with Shirley Griffith. We begin the story of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1932, Americans were tired of the policies of Republican President Herbert Hoover. They thought Hoover had done too little to fight the depression that was crushing the economy. They gave a big victory to Franklin Roosevelt and his Democrats in the elections that year. Roosevelt believed that the federal government should do more to help average Americans. The election brought hope to many Americans in the autumn of 1932. But Roosevelt did not become president until March of 1933, 4 months after the election. And those months saw the American economy fall to its lowest level in the history of the nation.
President Hoover tried to arrange a World Economic Conference, and he called on President-elect Roosevelt to join him in making conservative statements in support of business. Roosevelt refused. He did not think it was correct to begin acting like a president until he actually became the president. He did not want to tie himself to policies that the voters had just rejected. Congress, controlled by Democrats, also refused to help Hoover.
It was a strange period, a season of uncertainty and anger. The economy was worse than ever. The lines of people waiting for food were longer than before. Angry mobs of farmers were gathering in the countryside. And the politicians in Washington seemed unable to work together to end the crisis. Hoover said, "We are at the end of our rope. There is nothing more we can do." And across the country, Americans waited, worried, uncertain, afraid. What would the new president do?
The new president was 51 years old. His family name was well known to the American public. Theodore Roosevelt, a distant family member, had served as one of America's greatest presidents 30 years earlier. Franklin Roosevelt was born to a rich and important New York family. He went to the best schools, Groton, Harvard, and Columbia Law School. In 1910, he won election to the New York State Legislature. He showed great intelligence and political understanding as a state senator and worked hard for other Democratic candidates. Franklin Roosevelt next served as Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President Woodrow Wilson. And in 1920, he was the Democratic Party's unsuccessful candidate for vice president.
The next year, Roosevelt suffered a personal tragedy. He was sailing during a holiday with his family. Suddenly, his body became cold. He felt severe pain in his back and legs. Doctors came, but the pain got worse. For weeks, Roosevelt was forced to lie on his back. Finally, doctors discovered that Roosevelt was a victim of polio. He lost control of his legs because of the disease. He would never walk again. Roosevelt had always been an active man who loved sports, but now he would have to live with a wheelchair. All of his money and fame could not get him back the strength in his legs.
Many Americans thought the illness would end Roosevelt's political dreams, but they were wrong. He showed an inner strength that people had never seen in him before. Roosevelt ran as the Democratic candidate for governor of New York State in 1928. He won by a small number of votes. 2 years later, the voters of New York re-elected Roosevelt, and they cheered his creative efforts to help citizens of the state who were suffering from the Great Depression.
Franklin Roosevelt always appeared strong and friendly in public. He loved to laugh and enjoy life. But his happy face hid a strong will. Throughout his life, Roosevelt worked to improve life for the common man, and he was willing to use the power of government to do this. He thought the government had the power and responsibility to improve the life of its citizens.
Roosevelt believed deeply in this, but he was less certain about the best way to do it. Above all, we must try something, he said, during the presidential campaign of 1932. Roosevelt believed that the country demanded creative experimentation. Americans in large numbers across the country voted for Roosevelt in 1932. They supported his calls for action to end the Depression. But no one was really sure just what this new president from New York, this man unable to walk, would really do after he entered the White House.
Inauguration Day in 1933 began with clouds and a dark sky. Roosevelt went to church in the morning. And then he drove with President Hoover from the White House to the Capitol, the building where Congress meets. Roosevelt tried to talk with Hoover as they drove, but Hoover said little. He just waved without emotion at the crowd. The two men arrived at the Capitol. A huge crowd of people waited. Millions more Americans listened to a radio broadcast of the ceremony. The Chief Justice of the United States, Charles Evans Hughes, gave the oath of office to Roosevelt. And then Americans waited to hear
what the nation's 32nd president would say. He told them he was sure they expected him to speak openly and honestly about the situation facing the country. He told them that their great nation would survive as it had survived in the past, that it would recover and become rich again. He talked about the danger of fear, a nameless fear that blocked efforts to move forward. And he talked about Americans giving their support to honest, active leadership in every dark hour of their history. Here is some of Roosevelt's inaugural address in his own words.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
Roosevelt's words caught the emotions of the crowd. He seemed sure of himself. He promised leadership. His whole style was different from the empty promises of wealth offered by President Hoover.
Happiness lies not in the mere possession of money. It lies in the joy of achievement, in the thrill of creative effort, the joy, the moral stimulation of work. No longer must be forgotten in the mad chase of evanescent thought.
These dark days, my friends, will be worth all they cost us.
If they teach us that our true destiny is not to be ministered unto, but to minister to ourselves, to our fellow men.
Roosevelt said that the most important need was to put people back to work. And he said the federal government would have to take an active part in creating jobs. Roosevelt said there were many ways to help the nation recover. But, he said, it would never be helped just by talking about it. We must act, he said, and act quickly.
Roosevelt had a strong and serious look on his face. He told the crowd that all the necessary action was possible under the American system of government. But he warned that Congress must cooperate with him to get the nation moving again. Then, his speech finished, Roosevelt waved to the crowd and smiled. Herbert Hoover shook his hand and left. Roosevelt rode alone through the huge crowds back to the White House, and he immediately began a series of conferences.
Roosevelt's inauguration speech of 1933 was one of the most powerful and important speeches in American history. Roosevelt's speech was like an ocean wave that washes away one period of history and brings in a new one. The president seemed strong. He gave people hope. The new president promised the American people action. And action came quickly. During the next 3 months, Roosevelt and the Democrats would pass more major new programs than the nation had seen in many years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.